Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, June 14th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, PSP reports $93 million in investments over 3 years. Partnership. Member investments leveraged into $950 million. By Mella McEwen. Investors would be green with envy at the returns the Permian Strategic Partnership has enjoyed. The partnership announced Monday that it has transformed $93 million in investments received from the 17 companies that comprise its membership into $950 million in community support. That $93 million is over the 3-year life of the partnership. "We're pretty proud of the numbers," Tracy Bentley, the partnership's president and chief executive officer, told the Reporter Telegram in a telephone interview. "The rate of return is pretty remarkable." She explained that partnerships with other entities helped leverage that $93 million in PSP funding into $950 million. As an example, Bentley said that the Abel Hanger Foundation, Henry Foundation, and Scarborough Foundations joined PSP in raising $55 million to bring 14 IDEA schools, including IDEA Travis, and a second Midland school being built, to Midland and Odessa. Other partners joined PSP in funding Midland College's Pre-K Academy and Center for Teaching Excellence. Yet another partnership, with the Cal Ripken Senior Foundation, will give 134 elementary schools in 22 Permian Basin counties fully equipped science, technology, and math centers, serving more than 60,000 students and 2,000 teachers. Partnerships have extended beyond education to partnership with, among others, the University of Texas Permian Basin, Texas Tech Health Sciences Center, and Midland and Odessa colleges to expand healthcare training and access. Those include new or expanded nursing and pre-med training facilities at the schools, and working with Texas Tech to create a new surgical and subspecialty program. "We've made a lot of investments that the community will start to see and feel in a year or two," she said of the investments in medical training programs. The partnership also worked to bring $600 million in state funding to address Permian Basin roads. And Bentley said the PSP will continue to serve as the Permian Basin's voice in Austin. Investments have also been made in veterans programs and supporting first responders. "I would say we've exceeded expectations. When we formed in 2019, we set lofty goals to be transformative," she said. "We had a great 2019, and then 2020 hit. The organization was challenged to get back on track and make up lost ground," she said, adding that she and the PSP team are thrilled at how PSP performed last year. "The partnership has already made substantial investments to date this year," she noted. "The other thing that exceeded my expectations is we didn't lose a single member in 2020 to economic conditions," she added. "We lost some members to mergers and acquisitions." She cited founding members Concho Resources and Shell Energy, both now part of ConocoPhillips, Anadarko, now part of Occidental Petroleum, and Parsley Energy, now part of Pioneer Natural Resources. "Residents throughout the Permian Basin, including West Texas and southeastern New Mexico, can see PSP elevate its investments in education in order to support the young families moving into the region and looking for quality schools," she said. "There will also continue to be a laser focus on healthcare," she added, "and on workforce development." I would say the PSP is going to be around for the foreseeable future, said Bentley. I feel we've only just begun. We have years and years of investments to make. During the past year, PSP has made substantial investments to support critical community needs, including $34.075 million in education investments benefiting more than 100,000 students, $41 million in healthcare investments to improve access to the region's 2 million residents, and $14.7 million to train and upskill the region's 800,000-strong workforce. This article is entitled, Ex-Federal Prosecutor to Run for County DA. Harwood. I will work to restore the public's confidence in the Midland County District Attorney's Office. By Stuart Doreen. A former federal prosecutor has stated his intention to run for Midland County District Attorney. Glenn Harwood told the Reporter-Telegram that he plans to run for the Republican Party's nomination in 2024. The current district attorney is Laura Nodolf. Harwood worked from 2015 until recently as a federal prosecutor in the United States Attorney's Office in the Midland-Odessa Division of the Western District of Texas. He stated in an email to the Reporter-Telegram that as a federal prosecutor, he handled the full range of federal offenses arising in the six counties surrounding Midland, primarily narcotics and firearms offenses, child exploitation offenses, white-collar offenses, and immigration offenses. He wrote that a federal employee isn't permitted to raise funds or run for partisan office, so he submitted his resignation from the U.S. Attorney's Office and entered private practice. Harwood is currently working both as of counsel with Keith and Lorfing PLLC and as a solo practitioner in Midland with a focus on federal and state criminal law. As part of the law enforcement community in Midland, I had an inside view of the need for improvement at the Midland County District Attorney's Office, Harwood said in an email. For several years, colleagues in the legal community and law enforcement have encouraged me to run for district attorney. This winter, I decided to take the first steps to begin my candidacy. Harwood said he has filed his designation of a campaign treasurer and started a campaign. If I am elected, I will work to build a more collaborative, respectful, and productive relationship with the local county and state law enforcement community, Harwood said. I will ensure that the thorough investigations from the law enforcement agencies result in deliberate, thoughtful, and appropriate charging decisions. I will ensure that criminal trials are well prepared and professionally litigated. Finally, and most importantly, I will work to restore the public's confidence in the Midland County District Attorney's Office. The criminal defendants, the victims of crime, the defense bar, the courts, law enforcement, the employees of the District Attorney's Office, and the public at large are all stakeholders in the authority exercised by the District Attorney. I intend to consider the equities of all the stakeholders in every decision I will make as the district attorney. As a career prosecutor, a combat veteran, and an experienced attorney, I'll bring proven leadership, breadth of experience, and seasoned judgment to the office of the Midland County District Attorney. Harwood lists being in public service for nearly 30 years, including serving in the U.S. Army for more than 22 years. That experience included deployment to Iraq with an artillery headquarters unit in 2003 and again in 2006 with the 1st Cavalry Division. He also stated he was deployed to Afghanistan in 2014. During my 14 years as a judge advocate, I served primarily in military justice, criminal law positions, and as a prosecutor, a supervisory prosecutor, a supervisory defense counsel, and a military justice trainer, Harwood wrote. I retired as a lieutenant colonel in 2015. He lists being a member of the bars of Texas and Virginia and being licensed in the United States Supreme Court, the Fourth and Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, the Western and Northern Districts of Texas, and various military courts. He stated he and his wife Kimberly have been married for more than 30 years, have fostered 6 children, 2 of whom were added to the family permanently through adoption, and have 2 elementary-age children and 4 adult children, ages 18 to 25. He also lists having served on the board of a nonprofit ministry, Fostering Restoration Ministries, which provides support and services to foster and adoptive families, and being an active member of Stonegate Fellowship. This article is entitled, County Leaders Wait on Decision About DA Legal Fees, by Stuart Doreen. Where does the lawsuit brought forth by David Wilson to remove Midland County District Attorney Laura Nodolf stand? Monday, there was no change. Nodolf still hasn't commented publicly about the lawsuit or her representation. Midland County leaders Monday decided to wait until Tuesday or Wednesday regarding the payment of legal fees for the district attorney in this case. The court does not have to provide representation, according to county officials, but Texas law allows the court to do so if commissioners believe it serves county purposes. Wilson's petition was filed in the 385th District Court. County officials said Friday that Judge Leah Robertson, the presiding judge in the 385th, has asked the presiding regional judge, 7th Administrative Judicial Region of Texas Judge Dean Rucker, to assign a visiting judge from outside Midland to oversee judicial proceedings, including a trial if it goes to court. Allison Clayton, an attorney for Wilson, stated Friday that Judge Kelly Moore has been appointed in her place. Now that we have filed our petition, Section 87.016 of the Texas Government Code roughly outlines what could happen next, Clayton wrote Friday. We have requested the court issue a citation. If the judge refuses to issue the citation, the petition will be dismissed without the possibility of appeal. If the judge issues a citation, then the suit moves forward. At that point, now we are in Section 87.017, the judge can, in his discretion, temporarily suspend Ms. Nodolf and appoint someone else to act in her place. The case proceeds from there with the trial for removal. Another thing we could learn this week is whether County Attorney Russell Malm will represent the state in removal proceedings, as pursuant to Section 87.018D of the Texas Government Code, it was explained to the Reporter-Telegram. This is new ground for us, and we are still researching the issues, Malm wrote this weekend. My expectation is that I will file a motion to recuse myself. This article is entitled Midland City Council to Decide on Development Near Greentree, by Stuart Doreen. The Midland City Council today will decide on the rezones and a plat of property in northwest Midland, just north of Mockingbird Heights and just east of Greentree. The requests from Newton Engineering, including a rezone of 20.719 acres east of Midland Drive and south of Greentree Boulevard, from AE, Agricultural Estates District, to SF3, Single Family Dwelling District. The developer wants to build a single-family housing subdivision with 73 residential lots that are smaller than the lots immediately to the south in Mockingbird Heights or west in Greentree. The proposed preliminary plat of 26.46 acres of the tract will create 74 residential lots, also will go before the council. Lastly, the council will decide on a zone change from AE, Agricultural Estate District, to O1 Office District on a 5.720-acre tract in order to build an office center. As previously reported, city staff told planning and zoning commissioners that while the request for the office center is not in compliance with the Tall City Tomorrow plan, it would be advantageous as the city continues to grow northward. It would be part of the commercial corridor developing along Midland Drive and serve as a buffer between the arterial road and residential communities, generating less traffic than single-family developments, and would provide services to the surrounding communities and future communities in the area. The center will be built north of the planned housing development and right on the southeast corner of the intersection of Midland Drive and Greentree Boulevard. The City of Midland Planning and Zoning Commission approved all three items. This article is entitled Midland County Leaders Extend Burn Ban by Stuart Doreen. Midland County leaders on Monday extended the burn ban currently in place for another 90 days. The current burn ban in Midland County is scheduled to end June 26th, according to county officials. Despite recent rains across Midland County, dry conditions still prevail. The Keach-Byram Drought Index, which is used to determine forest fire potential, showed a score of 576 on Monday. That was 5 points higher than Sunday and higher than the score county officials use as a guideline for recommending a ban. Prior to the implementation of the current burn ban that was voted on in March, Midland County Fire Marshal Justin Bunch told the Reporter-Telegram that the county will not enact a burn ban until our KBI is at or above 575. The National Weather Service reported 1.67 inches of precipitation has fallen at Midland International Airport in June. However, hot weather returned with 100-degree weather Friday through Sunday and high temperatures reaching 105 and 104 on Saturday and Sunday, respectively. The NWS expects a high temperature of 99 degrees on Tuesday and then mid to upper 90s later this week. On Thursday, the U.S. drought assessment still showed Midland County under extreme intensity. The U.S. monthly drought outlook calls for drought conditions to persist. That forecast is consistent with the U.S. seasonal drought outlook. Other than Ector and Upton counties, Midland County is completely surrounded by counties with burn bans in place, according to the Texas A&M Forest Service website. This article is entitled, Midland Motorcyclist Dies After Accident in Martin County, by the Midland Reporter-Telegram. A 23-year-old Midland man died after an accident Wednesday night in Martin County, according to the Department of Public Safety. DPS reported Monday that Andrew Wade Hendricks was traveling northbound on his 2005 Yamaha motorcycle on Farm to Market Road 1208 at the 312-mile marker around 11:47 p.m. The motorcycle traveled into a curve in the roadway, and Hendricks lost control, according to DPS. That led Hendricks coming off the motorcycle and striking a pole. He was transported to Midland Memorial Hospital, but died there, according to DPS. This article is entitled, Odessa Man Dies After Collision, by the Midland Reporter-Telegram. A 41-year-old Odessa man died Saturday after a collision on State Highway 176 in Martin County, according to the Department of Public Safety. DPS reported Monday that Gabriel Lopez was driving a 2007 Nissan Altima south on Farm to Market Road 829 around 2:11 p.m. Saturday and disregarded the stop sign at the intersection of Texas 176. It was there that a 2018 Chevrolet Silverado traveling east on Texas 176 struck the Nissan. DPS reported that Lopez, who was wearing a seatbelt, was transported to Midland Memorial Hospital, but succumbed to his injuries.
Hi, This is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Tuesday, June 14, 2022, Education section. Holy Cross Catholic School graduates first class. The Holy Cross Catholic High School has graduated its first senior class. Those graduates are Kaylee Franklin, Matthew Crawley, and Kaylee Madrid. This was an historic achievement for the school, which opened its doors 3 years ago. We celebrate the success of three seniors who truly exemplify our vision of faith, virtue, and excellence, said Carolyn Gonzalez, head of school, in an email. They have persevered through the formation of a new Catholic high school and a pandemic. These three young people showcase the hard work and determination of our team of teachers and support staff. We are blessed by God to have this opportunity to celebrate the graduation of our first senior class, and we owe a debt of gratitude to our bishop, our community, and the parishes in the Diocese of San Angelo for supporting us all 3 years. The school celebrated their seniors with a tailgating party with games and food trucks in the last weeks of school, a baccalaureate mass, and finally, the graduation ceremony. SBOE braces for curriculum rewrite. The Texas State Board of Education is preparing for a once-in-a-decade rewrite of the state's social studies curriculum at a time when education policy is especially heated amid a conservative push to rein in discussion about topics like racism and gender discrimination. The board had been initially expected to unveil the new draft curriculum for its June meetings happening this week, but delayed the release until next month. It's now set to delve into the overhaul in a special meeting in late July with public testimony. Kevin Ellis, the chair of the board and a Lufkin Republican, said he's hopeful the board can avoid being drawn into a messy fight, given the national debates. We're going to have, because of what's happening in our country right now, a lot of testimony around that, and a lot of input and a lot of discussion. But I want to focus on what our students need. Texas has a long history of clashes over what's taught in schools, including sex ed content in health textbooks, whether the Civil War was fought over slavery, the influence of Moses on America's founding fathers, and evolution. This year's rewrite could be especially heated, coming after a wave of state legislation and school district actions targeting teachers specifically. Those include a state law banning critical race theory from Texas classrooms and restricting how teachers can discuss political issues with students. School districts have also banned books with inappropriate content, often including those that discuss LGBTQ issues. And last year, Governor Greg Abbott prohibited school districts and local governments from instituting mask mandates during COVID surges, actions that teacher unions opposed. Conservatives say the backlash is a result of the pandemic, when parents saw their children at home in virtual classrooms and witnessed teachings that they describe as having a liberal bias. Democrats say the crackdown is an effort to whitewash history, downplay the role of racism in America, and censor content about LGBTQ people.
This is the obituary column, Tuesday, June 14th. Cindy Hammond. Cindy Hammond, 62, of Midland, passed away peacefully surrounded by her family on June 9th. She was born on April 7, 1960, and raised in Midland. She is survived by her husband, Charlie Hammond, son, Louis and Jessica Hammond, daughter, Misty and Caleb Bryant, grandchildren, Nathan and Blake Hammond, Leighton Brakefield, and Kylie White, her brothers, Randy and Mary Ellen Sellers, Jerry and Vita Hunt, Philip Hunt, and Dennis Sellers, as well as many nieces, nephews, and cousins. She is preceded in death by her parents, Doyle and Doris Sellers, father and mother-in-law, Pete and Violet Hammond, brother Bobby Hunt, and great-niece Heidi Hunt. Viewing will be held at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home on Monday, June 13th, from 5 to 7 p.m. Funeral service will be Tuesday, June 14th at Temple Baptist Church, 4301 Thomason Drive at 11 a.m. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to Hospice of Midland. Funeral service is under the direction of Heavenly Gate Funeral Home. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to Pipkin at nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.heavenlygatefh.com. Death notices. Consuelo Postert Stone. Consuelo Postert Stone, 93 of Midland, passed away peacefully, surrounded by her loving family, on June 10th. Viewing will be held at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home Chapel on Monday, June 13th, from 9 a.m. to 8 p.m., with a rosary at 7 p.m. Funeral service will be held Tuesday, June 14th, at Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish and Shrine at 2 p.m. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. John B. Lee, 61 of Midland, passed away on June 10th. Cremation services have been arranged by family. Funeral arrangements are entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Online condolences can be received at www.asanchestfh.com. Mary Frances Dunn. Mary Frances Dunn, 93, of Odessa, passed away June 6th. She was born February 18, 1929, in Big Spring. The family will receive friends Monday, June 13th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the funeral home. Funeral services will be Tuesday, June 14th at 10 a.m. at Hubbard Kelly Funeral Home, followed by burial at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Patricia Brashear. Patricia Brashear, 95, of Midland, passed away June 12th. The family is not planning to have a service. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Sharon M. Williams. Sharon M. Williams, 73, of Midland, passed away June 9th. Celebration of life will be held at 2 p.m. Saturday, June 25th, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home, and online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Travis Wayne Hardy. Travis Wayne Hardy, 76, of Midland, passed away June 10th. The family will hold a private service. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home, and online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com.
Good morning, this is Kim, and I am reading the Odessa American. Today's date is Tuesday, June 14th. City meeting on Monday was not posted. FOI attorney says mayor's meeting raises serious concerns. Mayor Javier Hoven held a special meeting Monday morning with a Parks and Recreation Committee concerning the conditions at Ratliff Ranch Golf Links, and four council members attended, possibly violating Texas's Open Meetings Act. According to the act, governmental bodies must give the public notice of the date, time, place, and subject of upcoming meetings. Attorney Jim Hemphill of the Freedom of Information Foundation of Texas said the fact a quorum of city council members and the mayor met together without proper notice raises serious concerns. The posting of meetings is a requirement because it informs members of the public who have an interest in the matter an opportunity to hear it discussed, deliberated, and possibly acted upon. Hemphill said, it allows people to observe and have input on the matter. District 3 Council Member Deetra White, District 4 Council Member Tom Sprawls, District 5 Council Member Mary Willis, and Councilman-at-Large Denise Swanner attended the meeting. Willis, Swanner, Hoven, City Attorney Natasha Brooks, City Parks and Recreation Director Steve Patton, and City Manager Michael Marrero did not respond to text, voicemails, and messages with city staff. White texted she was at a doctor's office and couldn't talk. Deputy City Manager Philip Urita confirmed the meeting and asked permission to call back after gathering materials from the meeting, but failed to do so. According to the city's website, the Citizens Golf Advisory Committee hears complaints and other business matters related to the golf course. It identifies needs and develops solutions for recommendations to the council. It meets at least 6 times a year, and committee members serve 3-year terms. However, Sproul said the advisory board has been unable to meet for a long time due to COVID-19 restrictions and problems getting a quorum. The mayor opted to call a meeting with the board to discuss ongoing concerns about the golf course, he said. Apparently, the course is in pretty rough shape and people are unhappy about it, Sproul said. When asked if the council violated the Open Meeting Act, Sproul responded, "I hope not, but we didn't have the city attorney there." Sproul said he attended the meeting because he believed it was like any other event in which a quorum of council members attend separately but don't take action. He noted no one from the council spoke besides Hoven. However, the Open Meetings Act defines meeting in part as a deliberation between a quorum of a governmental body, where business over which the governmental body has supervision or control is discussed or considered, or during which the governmental body takes formal action. When asked if Monday's meeting violated the Open Meetings Act, City Secretary Norma Aguilar Grimaldo gave a variety of responses. She said notice of the meeting wasn't sent out to City Council members, it wasn't a called City Council meeting, and it wasn't a City Council meeting. She said she didn't know about the meeting prior to its start, but confirmed it was held at the behest of Hoven. When asked again if the meeting violated the law, Aguilar Grimaldo asked if she could return the call. She never did, even though another message was left for her. Hemp Hill, the Freedom of Information Foundation of Texas attorney, said it is unclear if the Citizens Golf Advisory Committee also should have posted notice of its meeting. It is not listed on the city's Agenda Center website. The Capital Improvements Advisory Committee is the only committee whose agendas are. Sproul said Ratliff Ranch currently doesn't have a superintendent and only has an interim golf pro. From what he understands, the golf course has had a fair amount of turnover, he said. District 2 Council Member Steve Thompson, who was out of town Monday, said he had heard Hoven was upset about the golf course conditions and was calling for a meeting. After seeing some pictures, he too is concerned. However, he is disturbed the council met apparently without posting appropriate notice, which the law states is at least 72 hours before the meeting, in a place readily accessible to the general public at all times. I sure would think it's an issue, Thompson said. He is also careful not to meet with more than one council member at a time, and he did the same when he was on the hospital board, Thompson said. District 1 Council Member Mark Mata, who did not attend the meeting, also did not return a message left for him. This is not the first time the city has been accused of violating the Open Meetings Act. The OA successfully sued the city of Odessa for open meeting violations in 2017 that resulted in the city paying legal fees as well as agreeing to record all executive sessions held by the city in the future. No other municipality in Texas is required to record executive sessions. The OA remains embroiled in another lawsuit against the city in an effort to force the municipality to comply with state freedom of information laws. The OA filed its lawsuit against the city more than 2 years ago, alleging the municipality was violating the Texas Freedom of Information Act by requiring the newspaper to file formal Freedom of Information requests in order to obtain police reports and probable cause affidavits, records that have always been readily and promptly available to any member of the public. The process resulted in delays in the release of the public records, which oftentimes contains information that was redacted. Edgman battling back from crippling fall. You've got to get your mind right, feeling blessed. For the last few years, Tim Edgman has been hearing that phrase whenever his grandson, Jack 8, plays baseball and other sports. The youngster's other grandfather, Bo Owens, is fond of the phrase and uses it often as a way to encourage him. It's now become Edgman's mantra. In fact, Edgman says it just might be the reason he'll be walking by fall. On Christmas Eve, the insurance agent and Odessa Development Corporation chairman arrived in Red River, New Mexico for the holiday. On the way up to the house they were staying at, two of the family's vehicles got stuck halfway up the long, steep, snowy, and icy driveway. Edgman, his daughter Amanda Owens, and her father-in-law decided to walk back to the cars from the house to get some groceries and toys for the grandkids. Tim fell. He landed on his upper back and neck. And then he slipped down the driveway, coming to rest against one of the car's tires. I never lost consciousness, but after I hit, everything below my neck was numb. I told my daughter, get an ambulance. I've got to have help. I have no feeling, Edgman recalled. The driveway was so slick the paramedics had to crawl to him with a backboard and slide him down to the ambulance, he said. His injuries were so severe, the decision was made to take Edgman to Taos, 45 minutes away. After a CT scan, doctors discovered that although he hadn't broken his back, he had a spinal contusion with significant swelling around his spinal cord. They also realized they were ill-equipped to help him. Unable to find an air ambulance to get him to University of Medical Center in Lubbock, Edgman's children sought the help of a friend and managed to get him a Christmas Day ride. A neurosurgeon at UMC performed surgery to relieve the pressure, but he was not optimistic Edgman would ever walk again. Not satisfied with that prognosis, Edgman's wife of 40 years, Teresa, and Amanda made calls to friends in the medical field. I've always heard that if there's movement and feeling, there's hope, Teresa said. Teresa and Amanda received encouraging words from their friends who knew Edgman had started to regain feeling in the ambulance and could wiggle his toes, albeit barely. After 6 days at UMC, Edgman was transferred to South Plains Rehabilitation Hospital in Lubbock. Unable to feed himself and lacking mobility and strength in his torso and legs. He stood on his feet for the first time since the accident with the help of a therapist and stationary bars at the end of January. Edgman was transferred to Moody Neuro Rehabilitation Institute in Lubbock on January 31st. That was rehab on steroids. They put you into the gym at 9 o'clock and you got through at 4 o'clock, Edgman said. Teresa never once heard her husband complain, and he never needed any prompting, she said. I am very proud of him, she said. After 4 months of 5-day-a-week therapy sessions, Edgman walked out of Moody for the last time on May 26th with the aid of a walker. His ordeal wasn't over, though. While he regained much of the use of his hands, the nerves in his forearms haven't come back all of the way yet. As a result, he sometimes has problems holding things, and he feels as though someone is sticking pins in his arms. The areas around his thumbs are particularly painful, sometimes 10 on a scale of 1 to 10, he said. Although he's still using a wheelchair the majority of the time, he's now able to walk short distances with the walker. He hopes the walker will become obsolete in a matter of months. Since May 31st, Edgman has spent 5 to 6 hours in his office and 60 to 90 minutes a day at Permian Basin Rehabilitation Center. The love and support of his family and friends have helped him immeasurably, he said. Teresa and his son, Ryan, in Fort Worth, kept his insurance company going with the help of his staff. When Ryan and Teresa weren't working, they were at his side along with Ryan's family, which includes his children, George 3, Henry 1, and newborn William. In addition, Amanda, her husband Jake, and their children Jack and Maggie 3 were constantly at Moody since they lived in Lubbock. When Teresa and Tim contracted COVID-19 shortly after his arrival at South Plains, it was Amanda who stayed with him 5 days a week to feed and care for him while Teresa recovered. Edgman recalled with fondness his tricycle race with Maggie and batting balloons to her, both great forms of physical therapy, he said. Every weekday, the family rented a handicap-accessible van and sprung him from Moody, and he even got to watch Jack play baseball a time or two. They also busted him out for his 65th birthday party, a party attended by 15 to 20 people who made the drive from Odessa. The Edgemans said they feel very blessed to have gotten so much support these last several months. So many people called to check on Tim, and many kept track of his recovery on the caringbridge.org page the family set up. Edgman said he was particularly moved when Higginbotham, his insurance agency's parent company, announced last month it would be donating $100,000 to Moody to commemorate his last week of inpatient treatment. Nursing Service Employee of the Year Shocked by Award. Marissa Molina loves working with youngsters, so she figured her choices in college were teaching or nursing. She chose the nursing path, and recently she was recognized as the Ector County ISD Nursing Service Employee of the Year. She is stationed at Odessa High School. I kind of felt like school nursing was the best of both worlds. I ended up doing my nursing degree, and I was working at Odessa Regional. My son was born early. He was born a NICU baby 3 months early. And so after I had him, I kind of had a reevaluation, Molina said. In her hospital job, there were 12-hour shifts and weekend and holiday work. I had a friend that was working for the district, and she was like, "Oh yeah, it's perfect for people who have little kids. I came here and I just fell in love with it. I love it. It allows me to be a nurse and a mom at the same time," Molina said. She added that she enjoys the involvement with students and watching them grow over the years. Young people who were in ninth grade her first year graduated in May. "That's a really awesome thing for me to see. All those kiddos that were little babies when I came here, now they're grown and huge," Molina said. Molina graduated from Odessa High School and earned her RN from Odessa College. She has been a nurse for 6 years and has been with ECISD for 4 years. Returning to OHS made her feel proud. When she returned, she was shocked because OHS was so much larger than when she left. She added that she didn't know where everything was. "They've added so much and grown so much over the years that I didn't even know half of the buildings that were there. So it's definitely different, but I've enjoyed it. I like being here," Molina said. She said she was astonished by being named Nurse of the Year. "I was honored. I was really emotional," Molina said. She added that she tried not to cry for the photos, but more than anything, it's exciting. "It feels good to know that your hard work pays off," she said. Molina was also amazed that the district officials who came through with the award kept the energy all day long. She said the recognition makes her want to work even harder and that she has maintained a certain standard. "I just feel like I have a responsibility to this school and to nursing just to help the kids as much as I can and let them know this is a safe place to come," Molina said. When COVID hit, the experience wasn't quite the same as frontline hospital workers, but school nurses were dealing with quarantining large groups, especially at a campus as large as OHS. "We have all the extracurriculars, and we were quarantining mass groups of band, football, and parents being upset with us, students being upset with us. For a moment there, it felt like we were in a lose-lose situation, like, if you don't quarantine them, then the people are going to be mad. Or if you do quarantine them, then the other side is going to be mad. We were in the middle, and it was a really rough place to be in for a while. But I just kept telling people, I show up, I do the best job I can, and I have to leave it at that. There was a point where we were staying until 7:30 or 8 o'clock at night, just trying to stay caught up. So I finally had to stop, Molina said. She decided they had to figure out some boundaries so they could have personal time with their families. Once we got those boundaries in place and got a system in place, it got easier, Molina said. When they were quarantined at home, they were allowed to do things from home. We created a Facebook page to try to reach out to kids and just different health promotion things that we were allowed to do working from home, Molina said. She added that she was grateful for being able to work from home and still be paid. Molina and her husband Oz have a 5-year-old son, Maxim. Marilyn Alvarado is the school nurse at OHS with Molina. She started in January and was at Odessa Regional Medical Center with Molina working in the neonatal intensive care unit. I think we're a good match for each other. We bounce ideas back and forth with each other, and there's not a whole lot of arguing between us. I don't think we've ever argued, but it definitely helps that we have a good relationship, Molina said. Alvarado said she was glad Molina was recognized. She deserved it. It was very well deserved, Alvarado said. For her part, Alvarado said she loves being a school nurse. I like the interaction, especially with kids. I feel like you want to be there for them, Alvarado said. She wants to advocate for the children, whether they're infants or high school students. Alvarado also has a 15-year-old son who goes to Permian. Quick hits, Juneteenth events. Black Cultural Council of Odessa will celebrate Juneteenth events June 15th through 19th. Schedule of events are as follows. June 15th, 6 p.m., opening gospel concert featuring Fred Hamm at First Baptist Church, 709 North Lee Avenue. Admission is free. Text concert to 40778 for VIP seating. Visit tinyurl.com/YCKF5TXW. June 16th, 7 p.m., Dallas Black Dance Theater at OHS Performing Arts Center, 1301 North Dotsey Street. The Black Cultural Council of Odessa will also present the second annual All-White Party featuring violinist Dominique Hammonds at the Odessa Marriott Hotel and Conference Center, 305 East 5th Street. Doors open at 9 p.m. Admission is $25 per person. Tickets may be purchased at the door. Pre-sale tickets available from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Thursday at Gavin Norris Law Firm, 413 North Grant Avenue in the Amerion Building. June 17th, 6 p.m. Annual Juneteenth Program at Blackshear Auditorium, 8 p.m. Shout Cheerleading by Welton. DJs Blue Boy and Demetrius, and L.J. Eccles and Band and Youth Dance at Woodson Community Park. June 18th, 10 a.m., Youth in the Park Activities, Rolling Video Games, COVID Workshop at Woodson Park, Noon Picnic, and the Second Annual Brotherhood Legends Car Club Car Show at Woodson. Car entry fee is $25. Bike Club entry fee is $50. Deadline is June 14th. Prizes will be awarded. To enter, call 432-978-4443 or 817-648-2902. 2 p.m. Proclamation of Velvet's Day at Blackshear Auditorium. Followed by dedication of Velvet's historical marker, Velvet's musical tribute, and Velvet's Endeavor reception hosted by Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. parade lineup at South Dixie Boulevard and I-20. 7 p.m. parade route, north on Dixie Boulevard to Murphy Street. Turn right on Murphy Street and go east on Murphy to Barrett Drive. Cash awards will be presented at the parade, 9:30 p.m. Hometown Heroes will be honored at Woodson Park Main Stage. Honored heroes are Dorothy Nelms, Frizella Whitaker, and Lee Ora Beck Reddick. 10 p.m. music by De King of Trail Rides. June 19, 3:30 p.m. to 6 p.m., Gospel Celebration with the Reverend Eddie Jenkins of Dallas at Bethlehem Baptist Church, 1000 West Clements Street. 8 p.m., The Blues is All Right at Woodson Park Main Stage. 9:30 p.m., Paul Cannon Band Concert and Youth Dance at Woodson Park. In addition, the annual Danny R. Wright Basketball Tournament will take place on the evening of June 17th and all day June 18th at Woodson Boys and Girls Club. The third annual Regina McKnight Volleyball Tournament will take place on the evening of June 17th and all day June 18th at the Ector Field House. The fifth annual 35 and Older Legends Juneteenth Basketball Tournament will start at 1 p.m. June 19th at the Woodson Boys and Girls Club. For more information, call BCCO at 432-853-1344 or 432-212-6700. To sign up for basketball tournament, call 432-978-8908. Visit odessabbc.org or on the BCCO Facebook page. Search for more first responders grows. A desire to grow their own has prompted the Odessa Police Department and Odessa Fire Rescue to join forces with Ector County ISD to introduce youngsters to these first responder professions. The idea for the program called Field to Shield came from Adrian Vega, Executive Director of the Education Partnership of the Permian Basin. Vega said he talked to Fire Chief John Alvarez at a community event a while back. Alvarez asked Vega if he could help identify young people who would make good firefighters. Initially, he thought it would be easy to reach out to Executive Director of Career and Technical Education, Carla Byrne, and Superintendent Scott Murray, but then he thought more about what students would make the ideal police and firefighter. His mind went to athletes because they're focused on certain outcomes and goals, and they're team-oriented. That's where the concept of Field to Shield came from. Vega said he pitched it to Alvarez and OPD Chief Mike Gerke and floated the concept to City Manager Michael Marrero, Byrne, and Murray. They started talking about a pipeline, what it might look like, and the idea expanded to CTE students and those interested in IT. Vega said some of the students might never have thought about becoming a first responder, but building a relationship might plant a seed. He likened the process to recruiting university athletes. The other thing we talked about is in order for this to be successful, it's really truly about building out the pipeline, and that pipeline is going to be strong if the relationships and the mentoring and the recruiting aspect are strong, he added. Vega City told the city that ideally they would need to identify a point person as a recruiter or someone to stay in contact with the students. The younger students started, the better. If this is a blueprint from a regional perspective, it could be used by other districts like Midland, Vega said. Byrne said ECISD is starting a dual-credit law enforcement academy in the fall. We've had criminal justice for a long time where we send our kids to OC. It's all dual credit, and again, CTE pays for their textbooks and tuition, but we know that criminal justice is very different from law enforcement as far as what the eventual outcomes are in careers, Byrne said. We're super excited about having a law enforcement program as well and having students' ability to earn college credit prior to entering the police academy at 21, Byrne added. You can enter the fire academy at 18. She said the fire and police departments have started visiting schools to get youngsters interested in the fields. It's hard to get young people to move here from other areas, but we know we have really great kids here in Odessa, and we want them to stay here, So it's better for the community for us to provide programs to keep them here and help them through, Burns said. She added that the district has determined it has a responsibility to look at not only preparing our students for the workforce, but what workforce needs are and whether they are providing programs that align with those needs. First responder jobs also offer job stability and they're seen as noble, Burns said. To join the fire department, you have to go through the Fire Academy and EMT training. Alvarez City is looking for people that are mature, responsible, accountable for what they do, and willing to be part of a team. Along with schools in Odessa, Alvarez said they have also gone to Kermit High School and are looking to branch out to other area high schools. I feel like if we recruit local talent, they've already got a vested interest in this community. They grew up in this community. They have friends in this community. What a better way to show some pride in showing that now I'm a first responder for this community that I grew up in, and now I'm a firefighter or a police officer, Alvarez said. One of the things they are exploring is a paramedic training path. People love the EMS side of things, but they may not be as into the fire side, Alvarez said. He said that's one of the things they're going to implement in the future. 85% of what we do in this community is EMS. Unfortunately for us, even though we're at 85% EMS, we're very busy on structure fires, grass fires, oil field fires, you name it. These guys get a lot of experience here in this department, and it has to do with the 903 square miles that we cover in Ector County, Alvarez said. He added that they are supposed to have 213 firefighters, and they are currently 24 short. People in the fire service can move on to the fire marshal's division, but they have to go through a police academy first. One of the things OFR offers is a yearly Citizens Fire Academy. We've had some individuals join the Citizens Fire Academy. That gives us 14 weeks with these people that we can show them exactly what it is that Odessa Fire Rescue does. We have one individual that's fixing to graduate from the Citizens Fire Academy that actually has applied here for Odessa Fire Rescue, so that's one good way, Alvarez said. The other way that they offer a tour of the fire station and let them ride on a fire engine so they get a feel of what the department does. On field to shield, Alvarez said he thinks sooner rather than later they are going to reap their rewards. Odessa College has a fire academy and runs an EMS program, so it offers the OFR and OC. OPD Deputy Chief Matt Davidson said they have identified almost 500 high school students to tell them about the possibilities of a career with the police department. Currently, they have about 30 vacancies. The department is fully staffed at 181 officers, Davidson said. Training can take anywhere from 10 to 24 weeks. You can't become a police officer until you're 21 years old. Fire can put them directly at work at 18. So we have a position called recruit interim that pays. I think it's right at $31,000 a year. We will let them take 6 hours college credit on duty and pay for it up front, and then they can reimburse the rest. The other times, we're trying to get them involved in the community. They help us with all of our events. They can help take minor reports on the phone. They assist other departments within the agency, like criminal investigation, patrol. They'll help with parade routes, stuff like that. So basically, what we're trying to do is get them involved in what we call the family, Davidson said. He noted that one thing public safety offers that private companies don't is a very good retirement plan. Like OFR, Davidson said, the OPD also lets recruits know they can serve the community they were raised in. Joining the police department, however, is a rigorous process. Everybody that has access to police systems has to fill out a personal history questionnaire. It is about 33 pages of serious questions about background for the last 10 years of your life, where you lived, have you ever committed a crime? It goes through the various crimes like crimes against society, crimes against persons, crimes against property, and then it goes into drug and alcohol abuse. And what it does is it helps us identify issues before we go further in the process, Davidson said. Once they have turned in the PHQ and all of their responses are adequate, they move on to the interview process, which is an oral board. If they pass that, they have a polygraph test based on the PHQ to identify any lies, Davidson said. The applicant then undergoes psychological, physical, eye, and hearing test. There is also a full background check conducted by a background investigator who will call references, look at previous employment, criminal, and driving histories. The applicant would have to answer any questions about their background and things that come up from previous employers and references. If they pass all of that, then they can be hired. So it's quite a rigorous process, Davidson said. OPD has to maintain public trust, he noted. Anybody we hire, no matter where they're in at life, they're part of the internal system that is the Odessa Police Department. They can go on ride-alongs. They have access to our computer systems. Maybe they don't have to log in themselves, but they're around computers that have access to our files. So a clean background is really important. That's why we have such a rigorous process. If some of these kids have made some mistakes that we can overlook, they lost out on the excellent opportunity, Davidson said. The police academy takes 7.5 to 8 months, and field training can take anywhere from 10 to 24 weeks, Davidson said. It's really set up as the individual learns because you have audible learners, visual learners, and kinesthetic learners learn by doing. So everybody learns differently. We've altered our field training plans so we can meet the needs of our recruits, our trainees, and maybe address training needs quicker. That way it goes through, Davidson said. He added that he thinks the Field to Shield program is amazing because these are youngsters OPD is already serving within the community. It's important that we identify those who are interested in a job in law enforcement because this job is not for everybody. If we can establish that relationship and keep the ones that are interested focused on what it takes to be an officer and prepare them for the PHQ, the background and everything, that's a win for the citizens of Odessa, Davidson said.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.